Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. After our recording, we learned of the death of American novelist Cormac McCarthy. Tributes were immediate and profound, reflecting McCarthy's huge influence through novels such as The Road, Blood Meridian, and No Country for Old Men. We'll include a lengthier appreciation in next week's issue, when we'll also be joined by fiction editor Toby Lichtig. I'm Alex Clark, and Lucy Dallas, the TLS's arts editor, is here with me. Hi, Lucy. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you, Alex. If a bit hot. I don't know what temperature it is with you at the moment, but it's kind
of... Not as hot as with you.
Oh,
it's
okay.
It's still unseasonably warm for Irish dwellers who are not used to this kind of thing.
No. Yeah, so, well, it's nearing 30 with exciting thunderstorms around here.
Oh.
So that's quite something. It's interesting for the garden, which is either baking or battering. Do you know what I mean? It's either baking or going, hey, ow, stop it.
Absolutely. Lavender's having quite a nice time in my garden.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, well, lavender's usually quite tough, isn't it?
Exactly. It's liking the baking. But, Lucy, I have to say, after 3 years of waiting, the peonies have arrived.
Oh, wonderful. Have you been waiting
3 years?
For
years.
Yeah. But it's worth it, though, isn't it?
That thing they do, that thing they pretend, the tease, the dance of the seven veils you get with them all budding up and then, but yeah, they've done it.
And are they very, very beautiful?
Very beautiful, a very, very dark pink. But I have to say, there's, in terms of blooms, there are 4 blooms.
Yeah, that's more than I had this year.
Fine. Thank you very much. But 3, you know, there's only 1 and a bit per year that I've been coddling them. And 1 I've cut because it was behind something larger, so we couldn't see it. And I thought that has to go on the kitchen table. So there we are.
That's very good. I've got normal peonies, as one might think, and I've got a couple of intersectional peonies, which means they're a cross between a tree and a herbaceous peony, which is supposed to make them tougher and more floriferous.
I don't even, is floriferous, is that a word?
Yes, I just didn't say it very well. It is a word, believe you me.
Lord, I didn't know that that was a thing.
Yes, it is.
An intersectional peony.
It absolutely is. And they're very beautiful, but they need a bit of coddling as well. They all, you know, for all that, supposed to be tougher than. They do what they want, don't they? But when they arrive, it's like people that, you know, turn up, you don't know where they're going to turn up to the party, but when they do turn up to the party, it's wonderful.
Yeah, even if they leave quite early.
Yes.
Mind you, I don't think that's a bad thing in a guest, to be honest. Nobody likes somebody hanging around.
No, that's true.
Mind sweeping the tables. This is very much me, or the last person to leave. So, you know, perhaps I should be more peony.
That makes me think of an essay. I read a book this week, nothing to do with anything, just because I wanted to. Have you ever read any of Samantha Irby's essays?
Yes, I have.
So she got a newish one out. I think it was May, called Quietly Hostile. Very, very good. Very funny. She's so good. And it's very graphic and quite kind of rude and bordering on disgusting. And then there's another side of it, which is quite kind of not quite prim, but proper, certainly, and kind of embarrassed if people mention things in public. And there's a brilliant kind of tension between them. She's telling stories from a very different life, but she's so brilliant. To be honest, I just picked it up in a bookshop because I like the cover. the last one I read.
They're very smartly branded, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. But I mean, when does that ever work?
No, you never.
Know? Never. And I loved it, so I would read anything she wrote now. So there you go. Have you read a book, Alex? Have you been reading any books?
I'm not actually going to say the name of the book that I read, but sometimes I pick up, when I'm a bit tired, I pick up a contemporary thriller, contemporary psychological thriller. Love
oh,
them.
Yeah.
And I was good that. 40, 50 pages into one that I just picked up off the shelf before I thought, oh, I've read this.
Well, that's disappointing.
I know. So I had to put it, because I actually thought, mind you, so old now, I thought, I don't know what happens. But I thought, no, there are books that I haven't read that I must read, especially because now we have a festival locally. I'm kind of completely delighted about this because, you know, I'm a bit festivaled out, but this one's down the road, so I don't actually have to pack an overnight bag.
Brilliant. You can just saunter off.
No staying in a Holiday Inn or anything. I can just saunter off when I feel like it. And it is a very fun festival, the Boris House Festival of Writing and Ideas. And I'll be interviewing Ian McEwan there this weekend.
Oh,
and
gosh.
Elaine Feeney and Paul Murray and Kellen Hughes and Claire Keegan, you know.
What, you're interviewing all of those people?
All of those people. Wow. I mean, it's across 3 days, not all in one go.
But you say, oh, I'm just going to trot off down the road and then, you know, interview half of the literary world. Well, report back, won't you, when you've done it?
Will do. Should we crack into what we're doing this week? Because actually, there's something else that is delightfully local to me. On this week's show, Norma Clark reviews a dazzling exhibition of the work of Renaissance artist Lavinia Fontana. And Kieran Settier joins us to talk about the evolution of humanism.
But first, a couple of weeks ago, you might remember we had Norma Clark on the podcast talking about Polly Toynbee's memoir. And after we'd finished recording, we were chatting about an exhibition that Norma had seen for the TLS of the works of the previously mentioned 16th century artist Lavinia Fontana. And she was singing the praises of the show to us and saying, you've got to go, it's wonderful. Well, this week her review is in the paper, and such was Norma's enthusiasm that we've invited her back to talk about it. And the timing for this is absolutely perfect, as you'll soon see. Norma, welcome back.
Hi, glad to be here.
Well, it's an especial thank you from us because you are not at home and you are actually somewhere amazingly appropriate for this little chat, aren't you?
I am. I flew into Bologna a couple of days ago, which is Lavinia Fontana's home city. I'm not actually in Bologna and I wasn't able to spend any time there, unfortunately. I'm about 2 hours' drive south, not far from Arezzo, in a place called Castello di Galbino, which is a 16th century castle situated in the most glorious Tuscan countryside. The nearest town is Anghiari, and close to that is San Sepolcro. So we're in the area of Tuscany that's associated with Piero della Francesca. There's the Piero della Francesca trail that people often come and do. So it's a real sense of being, you know, in that countryside that Lavinia Fontana would have known, even though she wasn't actually right here where I am.
I have to say, we've had some glamorous and envious making locations, especially in lockdown when people would say, oh, I'm in, you know, Hawaii or somewhere wonderful. But I have to say, now you're talking to us from a castle in the countryside near Bologna. I think, what do you think, Alex? I think that wins.
What, Lucy,
win?
Why aren't we in the castle?
I don't know.
How has this happened? How have you let this happen? This doesn't seem right to me.
We're very glad that Norma is there anyway.
It's really kind of you, Norma, because it's exactly as Lucy said. You were so hugely enthusiastic. We just thought, well, we've got to have you back on the show to talk about Lavinia Fontana. And I was really, really pleased because the exhibition is relatively local to me, a couple of hours away from me in Dublin at the National Gallery of Ireland. So I can go and see a fantastic exhibition without getting on a ferry or a plane, which is brilliant.
Have you been yet?
I haven't been yet, but we're getting my diary podcast fans. I have business will take me to Dublin this very Thursday, and I think I'm going to go this Thursday.
Oh,
and I think it's open late-ish. But it just sounds absolutely wonderful, and your review just makes it sound unmissable.
Well, it was, you know, I mean, as I say in the review, I really don't think that I've ever had quite that experience of just being enchanted the moment I walked into the first room of that exhibition. I think it's been beautifully curated. You know, the paintings are beautiful, but it has also been wonderfully curated by Aoife Brady. So you feel the pleasures of the colours, the ways in which the paintings have been organised into categories that make complete sense and hung alongside each other in ways that just do work. So it was enormously pleasing to be there. And we were there on a morning. They've got various other activities organized as part of the exhibition, which is until the end of August. And we were there when they had some students from the music faculty who did a very, very short concert of, I can't remember the details, I'm afraid, but it was music composed at the time by a woman composer. And it was just beautiful. And then a short harpsichord recital. So with the pictures on the walls and this music from the period, it did make a splendid experience.
Mm. I was completely fascinated that you were going to Bologna as well, because you also say in the piece that Bologna is like, she probably, or you don't exactly say this, but it seems as though she may not have existed or certainly been so successful had she not come from Bologna, because it was kind of an exception, wasn't it? It was an exceptional place.
It was. And Bologna is, it's really important. You know, who knows, you know, what might have happened, someone with that talent born elsewhere. But Bologna was an enabling place for an artist like her. And like many of these early women artists, she was taught by her father. So she's born into an artist household, and her mother's family have connections with the leading publisher in Bologna. And the kinds of people that were coming in and out of the studio were the sort of people who might commission a portrait. And she starts by doing portraits of well-known intellectuals, men associated with the university, with the church. And clearly that's facilitated by her father's professional engagement as well as social engagement with these people. But what's so striking is that she's almost immediately successful. She's immediately accepted as a professional painter. And the only thing that is distinctive, because she's a woman, is that she really does need to be married. And her father organizes a suitable husband for her, someone who has some training as an artist and helps out in the studio. And the reason for that is that she can't sign contracts. So she can't be a businesswoman. She can't be a professional artist because she needs a husband to do that side of things. Apart from that, you don't get the sense that it made much difference that she was a female artist rather than a male artist. And certainly not when she's painting these literary and intellectual and clerical men who she begins by painting. Then she moves on to the women, and there's a sort of elite clique of women that she becomes the favourite painter of. And her portraits of the women are so interesting as well, because what she shows is their power. You feel that these are women who wield, you know, obviously they're wealthy women. She's painting the wealthy women of the city, and she's showing them in a way that displays their wealth, but it's not, you don't feel that it's like that it's particularly for men's eyes or anything of that sort. What you feel is that these are women of substance and they know what they're doing, they know what they're about.
Her marketplace, was it that, you know, these contracts that she's has to be married in order to be able to make these contracts. She's working for multiple clients all the time, and she doesn't have a sort of single patron, as of course some painters do. So she has a kind of, I assume, a sort of flexibility.
Yeah, yeah, she does. She has many patrons. Bologna is distinctive because there are these 40 families, 40 leading families, the Quaranti, unlike Rome or Florence, where you've got one leading family. So all, you can imagine all these different families also a little bit in competition with each other to have, you know, the painter of the moment. So my impression is that she was really quite busy. She's, you know, pretty productive because lots of people wanted her to paint their portraits.
And as you say, she did the portraits of the men and then she did the portraits of the women. But that's not, she wasn't just a demure portrait painter, was she? You said some of her, especially the mythological scenes, which is where you can have a bit of license. They're pretty saucy, you said. She's pushing boundaries there as well, isn't she?
She is. There's one of Venus and Mars, which really did make me laugh out loud because it's the usual thing, the bedchamber and the naked Venus. You see her from behind and Mars is sitting, they're sitting on the edge of the bed as if they've got off and are about to get back on again, and Mars has got his hand on her bum, so as it were, either caressing or pushing her back onto the bed. I mean, and it's a big canvas, it's not a small canvas, and so it is quite funny, that one. Aoife Brady says that she's the first woman to do female nudes and writes quite a lot about the well-known fact that one of the problems for women artists was that they could not study from the nude. And she reckons that, you know, she uses her own body. So you've got a couple of large canvases there with the naked female. And yeah, they look very convincing. So you don't look at it and think, oh, she doesn't know how to do it.
Norma, I'm looking at this bottom pinching scene now. And I mean, it really is, isn't it? It's not demure.
No, it's not demure.
It's a proper grapple with a buttock in a sort of fruity kind of way. It looks full of, I'm not just being smutty, it looks properly like it's about sexual desire and enjoyment.
Yeah, that's right. It is. It's very sexy. And it does take you by surprise when you look at it. And you, you know, without any warning, I had no warning. I really didn't know her painting at all, which is, you know, partly what was so wonderful about going to this exhibition. And you come on that in room 3 or 4 and it's joyous, really. Mm-hmm. It's so full of life. It's so full of a sexy sort of life.
And she also did, you say, a huge amount of religious work, of this serious kind of commissioned, you know, very, very respectable, as it were.
Altar pieces.
Yeah.
Large altar pieces. And then this very interesting genre of Madonna and Christ child sleeping, which you've used on the page as the illustration, which is fabulous. I mean, because it just looks so good. And those, they think, were used in people's bedrooms as part of the furniture and, you know, part of the decoration, but also as educational aids, perhaps, you know, a way of saying to children, you know, here's a virtuous model. I mean, I'm not totally convinced by that explanation, but I do think that particular one that you've got there is absolutely exquisite. Not very big, but just exquisite.
It would be wonderful to have that hanging in your bedroom, certainly.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah.
The range is really incredible, isn't it? Just one of the many things that you're sort of getting to grips with when you're writing about her and thinking about her and appreciating her. And I really knew virtually nothing about her and looked at some of the paintings. And there's a really strange one, picture of a girl covered in hair.
Oh, yes.
And it's just so curious. And it looks, I mean, it's sort of obviously in a setting that's a, you know, Renaissance setting, but it's conceptually seems very modern.
Yes, it's a deformity of some kind. And it's very ugly, isn't it? I mean, it's very ugly to look at.
It's arresting, I suppose. You think, yeah. Oh, God, what am I looking at? You know, that most interesting of things when you look at a painting. What am I looking at?
Yes, and I don't know, I can't remember if there was an explanation about that painting in the very good catalogue. It's not a catalogue, it's a book. But I do recall reading that it was a deformity. There's a condition in which hair grows over the face. And I don't think there's any people know why she particularly painted. Very striking, isn't it? I mean, the other thing that's striking, going back to the mythological and allegorical paintings, is the contrast between the way that she represents the Judith with the head of Holofernes and the way Artemisia Gentileschi, a little bit later, not much later, also represents it, because Lavinia Fontana's Judith is a very composed, very beautiful, non-bloody version of this biblical story. So she's standing there, you know, much like the well-dressed women in the portraits, just standing there. But as it happens, she's holding this severed head, and there's a maid in the background. But you don't see that at first. At first, you just see this attractive, well-dressed woman who looks quite pleased with herself. Whereas with Artemisia Gentileschi, what you get is the tremendous violence of the act and the rage inside it as well. And I found that very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about, because she had this extraordinary professional life and range, as you say, and she worked a huge output, you say. She actually just painted a lot, as well as them being wonderful. But I was amazed when you told us about her family life as well. Amazed. Yeah.
Quite. So there you have this astonishing professional life, busy. It must involve a lot of negotiating with the upper classes of Bologna, and backwards and forwards and who knows what. Anyway, in all of that, you then learn that she gives birth 11 times during that period from the early 1580s up into the 1590s. 11, so 11 pregnancies at least, 11 births. And very sadly, but apparently not so unusually, only 4 of those children survived into adolescence. So the majority died as babies or toddlers. The one of the 4 that survived into adolescence died at the age of 14, just after she moved to Rome. And that was devastating, apparently. Mm. But thinking about what it meant to be a woman who was pregnant or had just given birth or was grieving for a dead baby, or some of these all at the same time, as it were. And then she's doing this kind of physically demanding as well as mentally and artistically demanding work. It does really quite blow your mind, I find.
And do you see it? Do you see any of this life in the work? Do you see any sort of changes when she was going through traumatic experiences like that in what you see on the canvas?
I don't know about that, but she does paint children, and she paints children well. Mm. And there's one really rather extraordinary painting which looks like a child on a sarcophagus. It's not, no one seems to know exactly what this painting is. It may be a baby lying in a crib, but it does look like, it has a sort of tomb-like quality to it. To me, I looked at it and straight away I thought, oh, well, it's a sort of sepulcher for a dead baby. And it may or may not be that, but that is the leading interpretation of that painting. So given that her life is filled with fecundity and babies and concern about babies, I don't think you see in the paintings in general, you know, the sort of trauma of all of that. I think what one would say is simply that she's very aware of children. She's very good at painting children.
Mm. It's sort of fed into her subject material, perhaps.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah.
And as you said, this is another thing that really struck me, that she was celebrated at the time. It's not like she was completely unheard of and someone has dug her out.
That's right.
You know, from art history. She was really famous and really successful, you know, and oh, well done us for finding her 400 years later. It's extraordinary, isn't it?
It is extraordinary. I mean, you know, obviously she was, you know, she was doing this, you know, she's defying the odds. It's very unusual and all the rest of it, and meeting all sorts of obstacles. But there she was, celebrated first of all in Bologna and then in Rome. You know, the Pope invites her to Rome and she mixes again with, you know, the highest and most powerful people. She is a celebrated figure. So how did she get lost from art history? That's, you know, that's the question.
Mm, mm, yeah. We talked about Rosa Bonheur a while ago as well.
Yes,
and
indeed.
You know, there seem to be more and more of them, and people go, no, she was very successful. Yes, everyone thought she was wonderful. And it's like, well, oh, okay. Well, okay. Why is she not in any of the books or the galleries? Yeah. Or you
and
know?
In this country too, there are a couple of examples. I mean, Elizabeth Lady Butler in the 19th century, who was painting military pictures, horses and battlefields, again, enormously popular, very, very successful, up to a point, up to the end of the 19th century, then she falls out of favour. Earlier on, and I mentioned this, Mary Beale in London in the 1670s and 1680s, actually the model of the professional artist life that she follows is very much that of Lavinia Fontana, in that she has a husband who does all the business side of things, who helps run the studio, and she begins by doing portraits of, you know, clerical men and intellectuals, and they are part of a sort of intellectual scene. So you can see real parallels there. And I don't know if Mary Beale knows about Lavinia Fontana, but would be wonderful to know if she did. The other thing I wanted to say, just thinking about these women who are reckoned to be the first women to run their own workshops, one of the things that Aoife Brady, the curator, stresses is how we do tend, when it's women artists, to concentrate on biographical materials, to think about their lives rather than about their techniques, let's say, or the details of running the workshops. And we don't really know very much about it. And she's right that we don't. And it would be wonderful if we knew, for example, did Lavinia Fontana have students? Was she teaching people at the same time as working on her paintings? How many assistants did she have? And what was the relation between her and them? We know so little about this kind of thing, but we know that she had 11 pregnancies. And of course, that's absolutely relevant because she's a woman. But it would be good to know about the workshop practices as well.
Yes, about the technical aspects, yeah, basically, of it and the techniques. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, thank you so much for, first of all, taking time out from your wonderful castle, wonderful stay in your wonderful castle.
I will just tell you, it's been terrible weather today.
Oh, no, has it?
Yes, storms and thunder and rain. So you don't have to be too jealous. I know, okay. Yeah, I know back in London it's sunny.
But they are Tuscan storms.
They're
Tuscan
storms.
Rain.
They are quite interesting. It's true. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me on again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Norma.
Still to come on the show, Kieran Setia on Sarah Bakewell's survey of the history of European humanism. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark. Sarah Bakewell is one of those writers who invites us to understand the complex ideas and movements of human history almost by stealth, immersing us via personalities and anecdotes, and then lightly segueing into philosophy, politics, religion, and literature. She did it with her award-winning study of Montaigne, How to Live, and again with a group portrait of key 20th century existentialists. Her new book, Humanly Possible, has a daunting subtitle, 700 Years of Humanist Freethinking, Enquiry and Hope. And Kieran Setiot has reviewed it in this week's paper. He joins us now from Massachusetts, where he teaches philosophy at MIT. Kieran, welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, I mean, this seems like a sort of quite a mammoth task, getting your own reviewer's head around 700 years of humanist, et cetera, et cetera. But I mentioned that rather all-encompassing subtitle. But in your review, you start with a very useful attempt to define humanism. And you also point out that it's European humanism that Bakewell is interested in. Has she kind of made it a more manageable task?
I think so, yes. She does talk a little bit about humanistic ideas outside of Europe, but that is the limited focus. But she goes back pretty far. So we find Protagoras in ancient Greece saying man is the measure of all things. And he's an ancient philosophical Greek representative of the humanist tradition. And we have Terence in second century BCE and writing, you know, I am human, nothing human is alien to me. So the scale of the book really is vast. And part of what makes the book so charming is that it doesn't attempt to come up with a single thesis that unifies this entire history. Instead, it's very much interested in the individual. So it's a book of stories in which particular humanists come to life in different moments.
That's very much her kind of modus operandi, isn't it? But there is this sense of also just trying to chart this thing that we do boil down to, you know, this one term, humanism. And as you say, it goes back so far, far before the idea that people themselves would have thought that they were part of, you know, a single coherent movement.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And what brings it together is sort of a cluster of ideas, a focus on human beings and on how life goes in this mortal world, not in some other world. So it needn't be atheistic, but insofar as there's a God, that's not the focus. The focus is on life in the world. And on progress or making life better, often through education with a kind of optimistic view about human nature, buttressing the humanists' hopes. And those threads sort of run through the various characters, the figures that Bakewell tells us about in the book.
You point out that empathy is really key to this. So, I mean, I thought, does humanism just mean, you know, a belief system that's not founded in religious beliefs or an ordered religion or a belief in a life beyond the here and now, but it's actually more sort of emotionally attuned than that, perhaps?
I think that's right. I mean, there's the challenge of the diversity of different humanists. So any characterization, immediately the voice in the back of my head is reminding me that there's 700 years of history and probably this doesn't quite encompass everyone. But yes, there's one of the central themes of the book is empathy. And I think that's sort of why it makes so much sense that it's built around individuals. So in its attention to individual human beings, individual humanists, it's sort of enacting a humanistic empathy for and engagement with particular people and how the world looked to them. So that theme definitely does structure the book.
So these are not always people that we will have heard of. So it's really interesting thing that you talk about the 12th century monks and why they were copying all the time. They're copying the classical writers, but they were copying partly because they had an abundance of rags.
Yeah, this is one of her great anecdotes, is that apparently the technology to make paper out of cloth had arrived in Europe, I think, from Asia. And because people in the towns were now wearing underwear, which had not been a thing before, there was lots of disposable cloth from people having worn out their underwear. And so the basis for the copying was this new source of paper. So yes, that's the gives a flavor of the book. That's the kind of memorable moment that one picks out.
Like the idea that 700 years of this great tradition is founded on people's old knickers basically.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
not to put anybody, you know, a distressing image in anyone's, but when you're looking around for a piece of paper to jot an idea down, you don't always think of your knicker drawer, do you? But maybe we should.
Maybe we should.
Maybe we should.
Exactly. This untapped resource. Yes, exactly. We should be upcycling our underwear into manuscripts.
Kieran, I'm so sorry. I've gone off on a tangent. And this is, I do get the sense that this is kind of what Sarah Bakewell likes us to do. And it's a way that she makes this information incredibly palatable. And certainly in the books of hers that I've read before, I found them so charming. I think the word you used, that you are sort of almost being educated by stealth. I am, because I don't know a lot of these things. But I was very interested in the idea that she really does explain how humanism changes form over the centuries. I mean, quite significantly, right?
Right. So we start with these Italian humanists like Petrarch and Boccaccio, who are religious, so that it's not that their humanism is atheistic. It's that while being religious, they're focused on recovering classical texts and using them as sources of wisdom for life on Earth. And then there's a kind of transition through the Enlightenment and then German humanists and humanistic education all the way up to the 20th century, where we find these humanistic manifestos that are explicitly atheistic and explicitly about the separation of church and state and the idea that ethical values don't depend on God. And so, yeah, she sort of maps that trajectory through representative figures.
And is humanism in some of those forms more kind of austere or sort of provocative kind of forms? Are they ever vehicles for revolution? Does that come up at all in the book?
That's a good question. I'm trying to think through the figures. I mean, I think one thing is that the tendency of the humanists, at least the ones that she's interested in, is to be very tolerant, very focused on progress through education, through changing people's minds and changing their values rather than violent revolution. So the general tendency of the humanist tradition is towards a kind of more intellectual engagement than a kind of material engagement. And this connects with something that she talks about in the book that I pick up in my review, which is an anxiety about the weakness of humanism, that it's too focused on education and places too much faith in that as a source of progress, as opposed to, or sort of underestimating, the power of physical and material violence. And so, yeah, I think it tends to be a little bit anti-revolutionary, a little bit more sort of incrementalist.
Is it that the humanists were maybe the people writing the books that sowed the seeds, as it were, but they weren't out on the streets sort of chucking things or chucking paving stones?
I think that's right. I mean, it's interesting who she includes and who she doesn't include. I mean, you could make a case that Marx was a kind of humanist. I mean, his vision was based on a picture of human nature and what human freedom and the realization of human nature would involve. So you could think of his contributions as a kind of revolutionary humanism, but he doesn't really show up in her book. He's not part of her narrative. So it might be that she's particularly prone to focus on the humanists who are more bookish and less sort of political.
I love that detail that you included of Thomas Paine at his trial, a sort of workaround of censorship. So his defense at his trial was to read his entire book out so that it would be recorded and could therefore be disseminated. Didn't quite work, but it's a very neat idea. But I suppose that does at least tell you that there were some revolutionaries, and there were indeed humanists that she picks up on who did suffer persecution, did suffer at the hands of the Inquisition, papal torture, and so forth.
No, that's certainly true. I mean, I think it was Paine's publisher who read out The Age of Reason in court when he was tried for publishing it. But yeah, the idea was that the court transcript would then have to be published. And so the book would be published despite the legal system. And yes, it's true that going back to these earlier figures, even figures who seem to us to be proposing ideas that are not especially revolutionary. So 14th century Italian humanists who are reviving the classical tradition and freedom of thought often got into trouble with the church and were, you know, tortured by the Pope or in other ways oppressed. So there's a definite history of suppression of humanist ideas that begins in these early days of humanism and then continues into the present. So one of the stories that Bakewell starts her book with is the story of Hamza bin Walayat, the Pakistani humanist who claimed asylum in the UK. And then the asylum process went badly because he was asked whether he could identify Plato and Aristotle as humanist philosophers, which they aren't really. And then eventually, I think, gained asylum. So that's a case where even in the contemporary world, humanism is outlawed. And that tradition of antagonism to humanism goes back very far into its history.
Mm. I was interested in what she says about the weaknesses, that there's a lot of faith in education. And I got the impression from your piece, correct me if I'm wrong, that it's a lot of emphasis on education and perhaps not as much on the rule of law or something, a bit too much faith and maybe not enough structure. Is that the kind of area where the weaknesses, where the cracks appear?
Yeah, this connects to the thing we were talking about earlier, that there's a kind of desire for and a vision of human progress. But the humanistic tradition, in a way, places its faith in education as the source of that progress. And the moment in the history told in the book at which anxieties about that really come to a head is during the Holocaust, during the Second World War, when there's a sense that in Germany, the place that was formed by educational humanism in the 19th century, that has proved to be no antidote to or source of resistance to Nazism. And there's these ideologies are not susceptible to defeat just by humanistic education. And there must be something else, some kind of acknowledgement of the role of force, the role of violence that humanists are a little bit squeamish about or a little bit hesitant to acknowledge. The moment where Thomas Mann, I think, says that this weakness in humanism, he's writing in 1935, so right in the cusp of the Second World War.
And does Sarah Bakewell, is she always defending humanism or does she kind of acknowledge the weaknesses? Or because not all of the humanists were lovely either, were they? I mean, of course they weren't. And as you say, there were a lot of them whose thoughts we wouldn't agree with now, for instance. And it's not as though they believed equal things about everybody.
No, that's true. And she does tend to be on the side of humanism and she's defensive in a way about it. So in response to this anxiety, there's a weakness in humanism and its faith in human nature. She says it's, you know, complaining about humanism there is like complaining that the traffic lights don't stop people from speeding or whatever, you know, like that somehow that the we're placing a blame on the force that was supposed to help to resist this kind of violence. The other place where that comes up in the book a lot is in the discussion of the racism of Enlightenment humanists. So she talks about the ideas of one of my intellectual heroes, David Hume, who was a racist thinker. I mean, he was in his accounts of anthropology depicts non-white people as inferior. And she again is somewhat defensive about that and wants to suggest that this is just, you know, a little bit of, I think she calls it daft, the term she uses, which I think is, you know, an understatement for the kind of ideology that Hume is defending. And it was historically influential. So Hume and then later philosophers like Immanuel Kant was significant in the development of what became scientific racism, the idea that there are inferior biological racial groups. And that legacy of humanism, I think, is something we shouldn't downplay or sort of wish away.
It's greatly problematic, isn't it? The use to which people's thoughts and the expounding of their thoughts will be put to, the sort of law of unintended consequences, I suppose. I was really fascinated when you mentioned Hume there and you picked up on this aspect of Bakewell's book, all these male friendships, this almost sort of homosocial kind of element to humanism, a lot of sort of partnerships between men, intellectual partnerships where they develop their ideas in tandem. Not a huge number of women involved throughout history, not a huge number of non-white men, or at least that's the lens that we see it through.
So she does go back to earlier figures in the history of feminism, like Christine de Pizan in Venice in the 14th, 15th century, writing the Book of the City of Ladies, and then Mary Wollstonecraft and Harriet Taylor writing with John Stuart Mill, The Subjection of Women. So there's a kind of subplot in which the history of feminism is entangled with the history of humanism. But it's true that the vast majority of the book is focused on a history dominated by white men and on these very intimate friendships between them, which again is in a way fitting given her theme, the idea that humanism is about appreciation of individual human beings. There is something kind of apt about the idea that at its core are individual human beings appreciating each other, being engaged in these friendships. But it is, yes, regrettably male dominated.
And such an interesting point you make. And you know, one of the things that is so enjoyable about being able to do this podcast week in, week out is when ideas kind of recur. So they're sort of things that maybe people are thinking about in tandem. But the idea of speciesism, Lucy, that's come up a lot, hasn't it, on the podcast recently? And it comes up again here.
Or rather, I would say maybe people have been talking not so much about speciesism, but certainly moving away from the very, very anthropocentric view that we've had for a long time.
Yeah, so this is a place where, in a way, this is where Bakewell's book ends, and she does not wade into the depths of that debate as much as she might, because a natural thing to think about humanism is, given the name, it's going to be focused specifically on human flourishing. But the idea that we should be specially concerned with human flourishing has come to be denigrated as a form of speciesism, as if people who have a certain biological commonality with us are thereby more worthy of our concern. And we get these radical forms of anti-humanism or transhumanism, post-humanism, on which we should give up on human nature and maybe welcome our new AI overlords, as it might be. And she touches on this a little towards the end of the book and expresses her commitment to a kind of humanism that would resist those post-humanist ideas. But I think the intellectual difficulty of resisting them, the kind of philosophical task of explaining why a commitment to human flourishing distinctively isn't a problematic kind of speciesism, that it isn't a kind of akin to biological racism, that it's not a form of prejudice, that I think is a serious intellectual philosophical task that her book sort of leaves us with at the very end.
Well, as the orcas are taking down boats throughout the oceans, as I understand it, and who can blame them? And as, you know, Lucy, we won't be doing this podcast soon. You know, somebody will be doing it for us, won't they? An algorithm. So I suppose...
We could have a couple of weeks off while ChatGPT does it for us.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But how ChatGPT and the orcas kind of sit? We just seem to be the sort of the fall guy for both of them.
Well, yes, I know what you mean. But actually, I think that's... I mean, I don't know, Kieran. Those are very much the extremes, aren't they, of what you're saying. And the positions, I mean, of the people who are saying, well, who cares about humans? You know, let's have robots or the orcas ruling the world. But the reality is, in fact, that that's we're a million miles away from that. And what's happening is that we just need to be occupying, you know, perhaps slightly fewer of the resources. Otherwise, it doesn't go well for anyone.
I think that's true. Although I do think we might be at a point where humanist ideas that have seemed in a way banal, namely, we should care about human flourishing and focus on this world, are coming to seem more radical, or they're at least faced with radical opposition and therefore call for a kind of sustained reflective defense. So while I think that the point at which you guys are replaced by ChatGPT is, I hope and believe, well, not just not in the distant future, hopefully never, but I think ensuring that we go into a world in which that never happens, like thinking about what the place of AI should be in society, that's the kind of thing that humanistic philosophy is and ought to be doing right now. Mm. And yeah, I think that's entirely compatible with worrying about near-term things like the preservation of the human and environment, the natural environment, and of lives of flourishing for human beings around the world.
I'm so sorry to have brought the orcas in. They just really frighten me. I think they have every right to do what they're doing. And in a kind of philosophical way, I support them, but they really frighten me. Because, you know, just to finish with your own most recent book, Kieran, Life is Hard, which we talked about on the podcast a little while ago, didn't we, Lucy?
We did, yeah, with Sky Cleary, yeah.
Life is hard. And I mean, it's hard sometimes because one is kind of irrationally, you know, frightened of a killer whale who's unlikely to come up my garden path anytime soon. That's one of the things. And it's hard in all sorts of ways. But in your book and in your work more generally, you do think that philosophy can help us navigate the hardness of life, don't you?
I do think that. I mean, I think part of that has to do with the fact that while there are irrational fears, a lot of our fears at the moment are rational. I mean, some are rational fears of loss and mortality that have been rational for human beings throughout human history, but others about, for instance, the climate crisis are the fears are just eminently justified. So we're in a situation where thinking about how to live as well as we can in conditions in which life isn't going to be perfect, in which we have to accept difficulty and loss and sacrifice, that's something that I think philosophy can help us do. And it's something that, you know, very many of us are struggling with right now, is looking at a future that's going to be challenging and asking ourselves, what kind of life can I hope for? What would be living well under these difficult circumstances?
And how, I wonder, you know, we've talked obviously about very big picture things like the climate crisis, which of course also are political issues. But when you look at the rise of, you know, fascism, neo-fascism, theocracy, where is humanism now in that sense, in a political sense, do you think? Just ending with a small question for you there, Karen.
Just a nice, easy one.
Softball.
I was going to say, this is, yes, exactly. You saved the softball question to the end. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of the kinds of resistance we need to, say, neo-fascism are going to draw on the resources of humanistic thinking. But I think they will also have to acknowledge the limits that Thomas Mann was worried about, namely that I don't think it's going to be through reasoning with people or just making a slightly better argument against some form of prejudice or oppression that we're going to make political progress in or politically survive in the short term. So I think this might be one of the cases where the weaknesses of humanism that Bakewell draws attention to but wants to defend against are in fact very salient. I think there might be limits to how much thinking these issues through is going to save us. And it's the time when we have to think more about collective political public action. We have to make like the orcas and start getting out there and trying to make a difference in the world.
There we go. Embrace the orcas.
Embrace the orcas. Yes,
be more like the orcas.
Be more orca. Okay. Thank you very much. That was fascinating and so much food for thought. I mean, I don't get the sense that I'm wrong to think this is a book that I'm going to enjoy, Karen. I've enjoyed Sarah Bakewell's previous work a lot. And I know we've talked through some of the sort of limitations of it, but it did seem that you agreed.
Oh, she's a wonderful writer, and it is a fascinating book. I mean, there are so many wonderful anecdotes in it that I couldn't squeeze into my review. So I encourage people to pick it up just for the amazing stories.
And also for your TLS editors to give you more space to get in more thoughts.
Okay, we hear you.
Kieran, thank you so much for joining us today. We enormously appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Norma Clark and Kieran Settier.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Charlotte Pardy.
We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, Alex Clark, goodbye.